Good morning and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, your host of this very fast-paced half hour of special topics and special guests designed to help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. The show is brought to you by the full-service law firm of Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, located in Fairfax, Virginia, serving clients all across the D.C. metro area and around the country. If you'd like to know more about the firm, visit us on the web at www.ofplaw.com. And if you'd like to make an appointment with one of our 55 attorneys, call us at 703-218-2100. I'd like to also invite you to subscribe to my blog, blueprintforwealth.org, where you can receive information, videos, audio, and articles on information of interest to you in the tax, estate planning, and business planning areas. And lastly, I invite you to read my articles and columns in the Washington Business Journal. Once a month, I publish a column entitled Blueprint for Wealth, and it has interesting articles on tax, estate planning, and business planning topics that we're talking about on this radio show today. Now, today, we're going to continue our discussion about the taxing ideas that have been proposed by some of the candidates running for president. Particularly, Herman Cain has introduced three concepts in his 999 proposal. 9% tax, flat tax, on individuals, which we talked about in last week's radio show. A 9% national sales tax, which we're going to talk about today. And a 9% tax on businesses, which we alluded to also in last week's show. The 9% national sales tax is nothing new. In fact, many countries, most of our trading partners, in fact, 150 countries around the globe currently impose a form of national sales tax, which I'll refer to as a VAT. Anyone who's traveled overseas to Europe, Canada, and abroad has had the opportunity to experience a VAT, a value-added tax. Also, there are different forms of consumption taxes. So a VAT applies to the market value that's added to a product or material at each stage of manufacture or distribution. So if a retailer buys a shirt for $20 from a distributor or a wholesaler and then turns around and sells it for $30, this tax will apply only to the $10 difference between the two amounts. A simple VAT is proportional on consumption, so that means it's regressive. It's imposed at all levels of income, regardless of how wealthy or how poor you may be. Savings and investment are tax deferred until they're actually consumed. A VAT is a consumption tax. Now, VATs in many countries exclude certain goods, intent on creating progressive effects, or they may be imposed at different rates on certain goods like food and clothing and shelter. In contrast to a pure VAT, which imposes tax at different levels of manufacture or distribution, a sales tax would typically apply only to the sale of goods and less often actually to the sale of services. This tax is applied at the point of sale, like at retail. Like a VAT, though, simple sales taxes can really hit lower-income taxpayers harder than other people, which leads to certain exemptions for such items as food and other necessities. There's also a concept that's similar to a consumption tax in an excise tax, which we currently impose under the Internal Revenue Code. It's imposed on specific classes of goods, typically alcohol or gasoline or even tourism. In the District of Columbia, they have an amusement tax. The tax rate varies according to the type of good and the quantity purchased and is typically unaffected by the person who buys it. There's also something known as an expenditure tax. A direct personal consumption tax may take the form of an expenditure tax or an income tax that deducts savings and investment. A direct consumption tax is also known as a cash flow tax. In other words, it is imposed as you spend your savings. This form of tax applies to the difference between an individual's income and their increase in their savings or their decrease in their savings. Like other consumption taxes, simple personal consumption taxes are regressive, and therefore they have a harder impact on lower income taxpayers. Consumption taxes, and specifically excise taxes, have featured in several notable historical events in the United States. In the U.S., we had the stamp tax and the tax on tea and whiskey taxes, which produced revolts, the first two against the British government and the latter against the early American Republic. In the early U.S., taxes were levied principally on consumption. In fact, Alexander Hamilton, who was one of the co-authors of the Federalist Papers, said that we really do need a consumption tax in order to properly run the government. Although personal and corporate income taxes provide the bulk of revenue to the U.S. government, consumption taxes do exist and do consider to be a primary source of income for state and local taxes. Sales tax, for example. One state that does not impose a sales tax is New Hampshire, and there are other states around that don't do that as well. Consumption taxes, by design, do not tax savings, which allows invested assets to grow more quickly. So, as an example, if you have a dollar of savings and you set it aside for retirement, at say a 9% compound interest rate, savings will grow to $7.86 after 24 years. On the other hand, if you had a 33% income tax rate imposed on those savings as they increase in value, the same $1 will be reduced to 67 cents for the initial year of tax as it's earned, and the effective interest rate is reduced to 6%, which means after 24 years, the balance of your investment will only increase to $2.64. That means that a consumption tax, which is designed to avoid taxing investment, will allow savings to grow at a much more rapid rate. Some critics argue that sales and consumption taxes can shift the tax burden to the less well-off. The ratio of tax obligation shrinks as wealth grows because the wealthy spend generally less of their income on consumables. An individual who's unable to save will pay taxes on 100% of their consumption, but individuals who are able to save or invest their income will be taxed only on the income that's not consumed. So you can see why there's some criticism being levied on proposals to impose a consumption tax. The most recent one that's been floated, of course, is Herman Cain's 9% national sales tax. They say that it's going to disproportionately burden the lower income taxpayers because they have to use their earnings, essentially, to pay for their consumption, the ability to live, their food, their shelter, their clothing. Now, many proposed consumption taxes share features with current income tax systems. Under these proposals, taxpayers would be given exemptions and a standard deduction in order to ensure that the poor do not pay any tax. In a pure consumption tax, they wouldn't allow any other deductions other than this initial exemption for those who are very low on the income earning totem pole. A withholding system also could be put in place in order to estimate the total tax liability. It would be difficult for many taxpayers to pay no tax all year and then be faced with a large tax bill at the end of the year. By the same token, if you're having to pay these sales taxes, not only on your state and local consumption, but on your federal consumption, then if you're at this low income level, the way they would administer it is to give you a credit on a tax return that you would file at the end of the year or after the end of the year. A consumption tax also could eliminate the concept of having to calculate your tax basis when you're computing the value of your investments. Remember, when you sell a stock, for example, or a piece of real estate, You have to know not only what it cost you originally, but any adjustments that you may have made to the tax basis so that you can determine the gain on the sale. In a consumption tax system, you wouldn't need to know this. All income that is put into investments, such as property or stocks or savings accounts, would be tax-free. As the asset grows in value, it's not taxed. Only when the proceeds from the asset are spent, meaning that you've sold it and you've actually taken the proceeds and spent it, will any consumption tax be imposed. If you took the proceeds and reinvested it in another investment, it would not be taxed in a consumption tax system. This is in contrast with our current system, where if you buy land for $10,000 and sell it for $15,000, you have a taxable gain of $5,000 and you would pay either short-term capital gains rates or long-term capital gains rates depending on how long you held it. One of the noted experts in this area, William Andrews, notes that there's an inherent problem with housing, for example, in terms of consumption taxes. Renters necessarily consume their housing, so they're going to be taxed on the expenditure of their rent. But homeowners also consume housing in the same way. So as they pay down a mortgage, the payments are classified as savings, not consumption, because they actually own the asset and they're building equity in the asset. This disparity is explained by what's known as the imputed rental value of a home, and they may provide exemptions for that. In any event, you can see that the concept of enacting a consumption tax, while it sounds appealing in many ways and is simple in others, may introduce new complexities and policy arguments that could last for decades to come. If you'd like to know more about the tax system, or how your taxes would be affected by these proposals, give us a call at 703-218-2100.